Nice to see such a full audience and for such an important topic. We're here this morning to address the theme of this particular concurrent session is Emergent Theories and Promising Practices in Health Promotion and Health Communication. My name is Elaine Ault, and I'm the CEO of Society for Public Health Education in Washington, and it's my pleasure to welcome you to this session on behalf of the Public Health Education and Health Promotion section of APHA. We invite you to become more involved in the Public Health and Health Promotion section by attending one of our business meetings, which this morning was at 6:30 a.m., but tomorrow will be at 6:30 p.m., or stop by the booth in the exhibit hall, emailing a member of the section. I'll be glad to talk with you later, or come to the social tonight from 6 to 8 p.m. In room 401 to 403. There are prizes and there's good food. So I'd like to begin in introducing our first speaker, but also just give you a little rules for the road here. We actually have five presenters. Are delighted that we have just top experts in the field for you. We'll like to hold the questions for each of them to the end, and we certainly encourage a good dialogue among all of you. The first speaker this morning, we'll get right into the program, noting I have no conflict of interest or financial disclosure to share with you as a moderator. And I introduce our first speaker that'll be addressing the Community Coalition Action Theory and Behavioral Ecological Model, Dr. Michelle Kegler. Michelle Kegler is trained in health behavior and health education and has 25 years of experience in community-based chronic disease prevention. Her research interests include community coalitions, evaluation of community-based health promotion programs, and how environments, both the social and the built environment, influence tobacco use, physical activity, and healthy eating. She's an associate professor in behavioral sciences and health education at the Rollins School of Public Health, Emory University, and director of the Emory Prevention Research Center, which focuses on preventing cancer and reducing health disparities in rural Southwest Georgia. Additionally, she is a co-editor of a very popular textbook on emerging theories in health promotion practice and research. Let's welcome Dr. Michelle Kegler.
Thank you, everybody. When Elaine pulled this panel together, she wanted me to say something about emerging theories. So I picked two theories from our textbook, one that I'm a co-developer of, so that would be pretty easy for me to talk about, and one that I was just kind of intrigued by, and I thought, wouldn't it be wonderful if I needed to learn more about that so that I could present intelligently at APHA? So we'll see how well I do that. I'm going to discuss two theories, as I just mentioned, and I picked these two because I think they illustrate important trends for theoretical advancements in our field. And these two trends are really increased complexity of our theoretical frameworks, as well as really developing theories that acknowledge multi-level influences on health behavior. I have no financial disclosures or any other kind that I need to make. Okay, the first theory I'm going to talk about is the Community Coalition Action Theory, and I'll spend more time on this in part because I co-developed this with Fran Butterfoss and know more about it. And we developed this theory in 2002, and at that time there was a lot of coalition work going on across the country, but there was a view that coalitions were atheoretical, and people were talking about how building coalitions was more of an art than a science. And Fran and I felt that there were some strong theoretical underpinnings to coalition work. There was also beginning to be an accumulation of practice wisdom. A lot of people had been working with coalitions for a while, and we had a sense of what worked. And we also were beginning to see some research and evaluation results. And so we pulled together these three sources of information into a series of what we called practice-proven propositions and came up with this theory. Just to make sure we're all on the same page, this is the definition of coalitions that we like. So it's a group of individuals representing diverse organizations, factions, or constituencies in a community who agree to work together to achieve a common goal or to do something that they couldn't do just by themselves. So it's the case when an agency or an organization isn't able to achieve the kind of public health change they want unless they partner with someone else. So there's this idea of interdependency. In recent years, the language has shifted a little bit, so it's not always community coalitions that you hear about now, but it's community partnerships, community collaboratives, leadership councils, consortia, etc., but the underlying philosophy is pretty much the same. Here's a very colorful picture of the theory. And I just want to make a few points here. First of all, there's an awful lot of variables in this theory. And I think as we start to acknowledge that the world is complex and behavior change is complex and our theories represent that, our theories get super, super complicated. So there's 15 big overarching constructs in the community coalition action theory. And some of those include community context, which in and of itself is a gigantic construct, as you might imagine. Lead agency, coalition membership, processes, leadership, staffing, structures, collaborative synergy, membership engagement, pooled resources, and the list goes on, including three sorts of outcomes that we're interested in: community change, community capacity, and health and social outcomes. So very, very complex. And there's also lots of ways to measure those boxes, and I'll illustrate that in a moment. But each of those boxes, you could come up with probably 5 or 10 or 20 variables to measure within that box. And then once you decide what variable you're going to measure, there's all sorts of ways to actually measure it. It's also a longitudinal model. It's not a theory that you can test in a month by quick collecting data and quick running some correlations, but it's a theory that unfolds over time. So it takes 2, 3, 4, 5 years to go from the point of coalition formation to community change outcomes. And lastly, many of the constructs in this theory are measured not at an individual level, but at an ecologic or group level, and that has implications for research and evaluation design in that the sample size is smaller. So if you have a large coalition project, you might have 20 coalitions, but from an analytic point of view, your sample size is 20. So think about your statistics classes and the implications for small sample sizes. I'm not going to go through all the propositions carefully. If you're interested in the theory, let me know and I can get you a copy of the chapter. But as I mentioned, this is organized by a series of propositions, and these propositions here have to do with the stages of development. And this is just the notion that coalitions are dynamic. They develop through stages, so they can form, they can go into a maintenance stage, they can be institutionalized, or they can get a new grant and reformulate themselves. So it's a cyclical process. At each stage, different factors influence effectiveness at that stage. So one set of factors might facilitate formation, and another set might facilitate maintenance or institutionalization. The theory purports that community context is critical and affects every single aspect of coalition functioning. We have a few propositions related to the lead agency, and the main points here are that coalition formation is more likely to be successful when the lead agency or convener group has technical expertise, financial resources, material support, and when it's connected to community gatekeepers. We have a couple of propositions about coalition membership, and this is the idea that coalitions usually start with a small core group, but effective ones expand to include broad community representation that's diverse. Then we have some propositions about process, and here we highlight communication, decision-making, and conflict management. Now I'm skipping over some other propositions and going to collaborative synergy. And this is really the way that coalitions work. The reason that we believe that they're more effective than single agency solutions And it's the idea that if you have a diverse coalition membership, you're pooling expertise, you're pooling connections, you're pooling perspectives, talents, resources from the organizations represented, and that pooling of different resources and perspectives allows for creative solutions that are better grounded in the community context, also builds community ownership. So that's the reason that we think coalitions can be more effective than single agency interventions. So kind of the idea that the whole is greater than the sum of its parts. And then we highlight three sorts of outcomes: community change, health and social outcomes, and community capacity. So what kind of evidence is there for this theory? And this is where these complex theories get challenging, I think. There's quite a bit of cross-sectional research. So people have done a lot of surveys of coalition membership, measured member satisfaction, member participation, leadership decision-making, and run a lot of correlations or bivariate associations. And for the most part, those sorts of studies do support little pieces of the theory. We also have a series of case studies which are consistent with the theory. They don't really prove that the theory is right, but they don't prove it's wrong either. They kind of make it seem like it works, like it's legit. But what's really hard in community-based projects and coalition projects in particular is designing studies where you can say, yes, it's absolutely because there was a coalition that it worked. You know, that would involve having 30, 40 communities having coalitions in half, not having coalitions in the other half, and seeing a difference in the communities that had coalitions. And from just a practical point of view, that kind of research is really hard. It's hard to tell a community, you can't have a, you can't collaborate, you have to just do this with your single agency. I want to just quickly go over how I've tried to test the theory with some secondary data, and this is often how we have to test these complex theories. I was hired as the evaluator for California Healthy Cities and Communities, and we collected a massive amount of data, and so a few years after that evaluation, I got to thinking maybe we could take some of that data we collected in that evaluation and use it to test this theory. And so we collected existing documents. We did two surveys of coalition members. We did site visits, interviews, and focus groups, just a huge amount of data, both qualitative and quantitative. And so these are some of the measures that were consistent with the theory that we were able to calculate based on our evaluation data. So you can see it was quite a few process variables, those in white. The blue were constructs from the middle of the theory in the community engagement section of the theory, and then the green were constructs that we used to measure community capacity. And so that was new skills, new partnerships, social capital, and sense of community. We were also able to construct some more creative measures from our qualitative data, and this included coalition structure, size and complexity, pooled resources, how many dollars were leveraged, what was the diversity of funding, community change outcomes, policy change, and program expansion, and then some indicators of community capacity. So this is going to come out in Health Education and Behavior soon, maybe January, but basically it shows how we tried to make the theory come to life and how we tried to operationalize it. So each of those variables within the box is what we were able to measure. And you can see how it gets exponentially complicated once you start adding variables in. And this is just some of the findings that we were able to demonstrate, and this is looking at the middle part of the theory over to the right part of the theory. So we have member engagement variables, pooled resources, and community change outcomes, and their correlations with indicators of community capacity. And so we found some evidence that the theory worked. We saw that, let's see if I can tell what's bolded here, that member satisfaction was related to member skills. Dollars leveraged was related to new leadership opportunities and things like that. This theory has a lot of implications for practitioners, and basically they parallel the propositions, and so I'll run through just a few of them quickly. The theory suggests that practitioners should select lead agencies with support, credibility in the community, and valuable networks. You should enlist gatekeepers that are able to develop trust and credibility within the community. Be sure to expand the core group to include broader representation from the community. And of course, effective processes are critical to keeping members engaged and happy and pooling their resources. Leadership is important. We believe that paid staff is important to keep coalitions moving forward. Comprehensive assessments that include both needs and assets are critical, and then planning and implementing strategies at multiple levels of the social ecology is more likely to lead to community change outcomes. Okay, I'm going to move into the next theory now, and this is a behavioral ecological model. Raise your hand if you've ever heard of this. Oh, wow. Oh, no. That's good, but you'll probably understand it better than I do. Okay, so this was developed by Mel Hovell and colleagues at San Diego State University, actually. And it's an attempt to integrate the natural sciences with the behavioral and social sciences. So it acknowledges things that you might remember from your undergraduate days, Darwin and natural selection. And takes the ideas of operant conditioning and learning theory and applies it at the group level and community level and society level. So it really takes a selectionistic model and expands it upward in the social ecology. Like community coalition action theory, it's a very complicated model, somewhat hard to understand and hard to study from a quantitative perspective anyway. Here's just a few of the highlights from the theory. And if you think back to Psychology 101, you'll remember the first three ideas from it, operant conditioning, learning theory, and that's where social and physical reinforcement following a behavior increased the likelihood of that behavior. So think back to the rat that pushed the bar and got a food pellet. Contingencies of reinforcement, that's the idea that you can shape behavior by manipulating the reinforcement, both social and physical, after a behavior. And I'm going to try to explain in a little more depth the concept of meta-contingencies, because I think that that's helpful and could provide a theoretical base for what we're doing an awful lot of now, which is systems change, policy change, and environmental change. So the example that Hovell uses in the book, first of all, let me just explain that this is an approach where group behavior can be established and maintained based on group level contingencies. And so you think about setting up rewards for a group behaving in a certain way. And when I try to think of how this applies to our field, first let me say that the example he gives is firefighters. Firefighters need to work collaboratively, work together to efficiently put out a fire. And they are reinforced for that collaborative behavior by the homeowners who are happy that their house wasn't burned down, by the city council who's happy that homes and apartments and places weren't destroyed, and also by the media that gives them accolades for good firefighting. And so that reinforces this collaborative group behavior. So when we try to think of what kind of reinforcement mechanisms do we have in public health to enforce group behavior that achieves public health goals, I was kind of thinking about healthcare reform and how it's using some of these theories or constructs in the shaping of healthcare reform. So if we wanted to get a clinic, say, or a health system to offer more preventive services, that requires collaborative or collective behavior or systems change in that organization. And so this theory tells us that we need to offer a reinforcement structure that supports that collaborative or collective behavior. And I think we're doing that with healthcare reform, where the financial reimbursement system will be changed and a little bit linked to group behavior, provider behavior, meeting standards of care. Perhaps there'll be some social recognition, or perhaps we could think about social or public recognition for systems that perform well in offering preventive care, and actually financial reimbursement for prevention services. So as health educators and health promoters, we can think about systems or groups and what reward structures we can put in place to encourage that collective behavior. Just some other key constructs related to this model. are that in order to change the behavior of populations, we need to understand the behavior of populations. I think oftentimes in health education, we just think about our individual level theories, and when we're trying to create larger scale change, we still take those individual theories. But what this is telling us is no. Think about populations and systems and develop and use theoretical ideas at that higher level. This approach doesn't deal with what Hovell and Skinner call mentalism. You don't have to figure out what's going on in someone's head. You know something's going on inside their head, but you as the behavior change person just needs to set up the reinforcement contingencies to change the behavior. So it argues that selectionistic mechanisms are key to understanding behavior, and that population behavior can be changed through group contingencies. Here's a picture of the model, and it's complicated. It shows that there are internal factors to a person that influence their behavior, external factors, multiple levels internal and multiple levels external, and all of these work to shape the behavior possibilities, shape the reinforcers, and shape the stimuli that trigger behavior. So with that, I'm going to wind down. And the main points that I want you to get from this presentation are that our theories are really shifting to be incredibly complex, and that this is challenging for us. It's exciting for us because I think that partly explains why we haven't had the greatest success in behavior change, because we've been a little simplistic. It probably does take theories that are this complex, but how we work with them, I think we're still trying to figure out. These approaches give higher priority to changing the behavior of change agents or decision makers, not necessarily program participants. It focuses on large-scale change, changing systems, changing organizations, changing communities. Empirical evidence is tricky for these theories. It's hard to know if they're right or not, because we usually can evaluate just little pieces of them. And so the only way we're going to move forward, I think, as a field, is collect up these little pieces of evidence. So view these as kind of organizing frameworks for packaging our studies to see if the general approach makes sense. And unfortunately, our current research and evaluation tools are not the greatest match for these. Randomized controlled trials are really hard to apply to these sorts of theories, and so I think we need some creativity in how we're going to embrace these more complex theories in our field. Thank you.